Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the health care they need. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. Today on our show, we take a look at why domestic violence rates in the San Joaquin Valley have been rising. And we hear one survivor's story. Her abuser was a Clovis police officer. I'm Laura Satsui.
And I'm Monica Velez. We also hear from mental health educators who work with high schoolers and other youth. Kids are learning the signs of mental illness and if a career in mental health is for them.
But first, a recap of this week's news. Monica, you've been reporting on priests accused of sexual abuse in the Roman Catholic Diocese of Fresno. What's going on here?
Yeah, well, last week, a law firm, Jeff Anderson and Associates, released a report naming 43 priests in the Fresno Diocese who have been publicly accused of sexual assault. This week, the diocese confirmed that one of the priests listed, Father Eric Swearingen, was put on paid leave.
How many there actually are that the bishop knows about, we don't know. So we released that report with the idea of alerting communities.
That was Jeff Anderson, founder of the firm. He says the firm released a list of names because the diocese hasn't yet released its own report. Officials at the diocese say they are working on compiling a list of accused priests that will be made public. But many other dioceses in California have already released similar reports. So Fresno is behind on that front.
Well, speaking of issues that affect the whole state, up at the state capitol, lawmakers have been negotiating the budget all week. One of the items in the $215 billion budget approved yesterday is the Safe and Affordable Drinking Water Fund, which would pay for drinking water cleanup projects in disadvantaged communities. Governor Gavin Newsom's original proposal was a tax on water users, but that's been thrown out. Now it's looking like it'll draw instead from mostly cap-and-trade funds to the tune of about $130 million a year. Jonathan Nelson is the director of policy for the Community Water Center. It's a group that's been advocating for clean water in rural and disadvantaged communities in California.
That is historic. It's unprecedented. And the fact that those fundings will be prioritized for our most vulnerable communities in both rural and urban areas is unprecedented.
We should note many of these communities are here in the Central Valley. The fund is still up in the air. However, until the legislature finalizes the budget and trailer bills and Newsom signs them. Also this week, the American Civil Liberties Union filed a lawsuit in Fresno.
That's right. The Fresno County Elections Office was sued over its decision to move a polling place away from the Unitarian Universalist Church that has a Black Lives Matter poster displayed out front. The ACLU claims the posters broke no election laws. Here's staff attorney Molly Lee.
It's an important free speech issue, and it also really lifts up some racial justice issues in Fresno.
The lawsuit demands that the county admit it violated the church's First Amendment rights. The county put out a press release where it said the issue wasn't with the content of the sign, but instead, quote, the politically charged nature of the sign and its effect on potential voters, end quote. This isn't the first time that church and its signs have been in the news. It's even had to replace them in the past because of graffiti and other vandalism incidents.
Lastly, eligible Valley residents can now apply for a spot on the 2nd Citizens Redistricting Commission, which will redistrict the state's congressional, Senate, Assembly, and the Board of Equalization districts. This only happens once every decade during the census, and last time around, Valley applicants were among the lowest. Out of the 14 people on the commission, the closest representative to the Southern Valley was from Stockton. So that's why Stephanie Ramirez Ridgway, the chief counsel for the California State Auditor, is urging Central Valley residents to apply.
I would say that anytime you have a local person deciding important issues for you, that gives you an opportunity, a greater opportunity to influence those decisions and to play a role.
The application is open until August 9th. And there are certain requirements, like being a registered voter since July 2015. You can find the full list on the California Auditor's website.
And listen for more FM 89 news every weekday during Morning Edition and All Things Considered. The Central Valley is home to many immigrant communities, but we often meet them after they've settled down. Today, we bring you a story about those in the middle of their journey. Many arrive at the San Ysidro Port of Entry in San Diego. It's become California's ground zero for the bottleneck of asylum seekers trying to make it to the United States. KQED's Alex Hall recently got an inside look at the place where asylum seekers are held, out of view, down several flights of stairs from where most people cross the U.S.-Mexico border.
We are now entering the pedestrian building.
On a busy Friday morning, San Ysidro's port director Sydney Akee shows reporters the pedestrian crossing. Here, travelers stand in line for a Customs and Border Protection officer to check their documents.
Morning, good morning.
More than 75,000 people cross here every day from Mexico to the U.S., but that's not the port's only traffic. In another wing of the building, men and women from Africa, the Caribbean, and Central America stand single file in silence, hands behind their backs. A few women hold small children.
This is part of our morning intake for today, so asylum seekers.
When people come to the border to ask for asylum, they usually have to wait their turn in Tijuana for weeks or months. The migrants here today will finally get their chance to explain to the U.S. government why they're afraid to return to their countries. Then they'll wait for a new date to appear in immigration court.
So if you guys could drop any phones, cameras, recording equipment.
A border officer tells us that journalists are not allowed to record where we're going next, down into the basement.
Backpacks, so just only pen and pad can go.
You can't hear this part, but we descend a stairway and enter an area called the Admissibility Enforcement Unit. This is where the migrants are taken next. Inside holding cells, much like a jail, they sit on metal benches or use a toilet behind a waist-high divider. They're given aluminum blankets and thin sleeping mats. CBP standards say that detainees should not be held here for longer than 72 hours, but officials acknowledge that limit is often exceeded. Before visiting the port, I talked to people who were recently detained here. Carmen Lobo from El Salvador is one migrant who said medical attention in the facility was delayed.
Me pegó dolor de mi vientre, dolor de mi espalda.
Lobo says that one day in March, she started vomiting and felt pain in her abdomen and back, so she asked to see a doctor. Hours later, she was examined and told she was having symptoms of a miscarriage. That was around 7 p.m. The ambulance arrived at midnight, she says.
Tenía mi pantalón bien manchado. De sangre.
She says when she returned from the hospital, her pants were stained with blood. The next day, she says, she was sent back to Mexico. Other migrants reported officers pressured them to sign documents and that at times officers denied food or used physical force against migrants. After the tour, I talked to Port Director Sydney Akee. He says Customs and Border Protection only takes in a certain number of asylum seekers each day so that conditions and care are not compromised.
If we overload individuals into our custody, there is a somewhat decrease in care. Individuals may not get the proper checks for medical care, may not get fed in a timely manner.
When asked about the allegations, a spokeswoman said CBP strongly disagrees with the reports and investigates all formal complaints. She said that the agency treats those in its custody with dignity and respect and provides multiple avenues to report any misconduct.
That story was reported by Alex Hall, KQED's Central Valley reporter. You can hear more of her work on The California Report, which airs weekday mornings here on Valley Public Radio.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Monica Velez. Victims of domestic violence are often reluctant to report their attackers, but it can be even harder to call the police if the abuser is a cop, too. This story, which takes place in Sanger, first aired on the California Report magazine as part of a statewide media collaboration looking at police misconduct. And before you hear it, we should note there are some disturbing descriptions of assault. KQED's Susie Rocho starts us off.
One afternoon, shortly after they started dating, Desiree Martinez was over at Kyle Pennington's house, hanging out in his pool.
There was a bee and it was like kind of drowning.
She says Kyle carefully plucked the insect out of the water.
That is so sweet. If he can save a bee, like he would never hurt me.
Then 3 months later, she made this call.
911, state your emergency. Hello?
Never mind. It's okay because I don't want to get him in trouble.
Desiree now says Kyle pushed her down the stairs that night. But as you can hear, she wasn't sure about involving the police. If you know anything about domestic violence, you probably know that people who feel trapped and abused by their partners are often reluctant to come forward. But in this case, there was another factor.
Okay, get who in trouble?
My boyfriend. Because he's a cop. I don't
want to
get him in trouble.
He's a cop?
Kyle was a police officer in the small Central Valley town of Clovis. Today's story is about what can happen when the very people you'd call for help know and even work with your abuser.
We have a woman who is begging these officers, saying, I'm scared of him. He choked me. He in a hotel room. He beat me. He's going to kill me.
Desiree Martinez's case is currently being considered by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Their ruling could hold other officers accountable for failing to act when an abuser is one of their own. KQED's Suki Lewis brings us Desiree's story.
When they first met, Desiree saw Kyle as a protector. He was a muscular 220 pounds with a military haircut. She was about 5'4", with brown eyes. She'd been in a violent relationship before, and the fact that he was in the military and a cop made her feel safe.
He just treated me like a princess, and I was like, just like, oh my gosh, I've never been treated like this before.
It was 2013. They'd been going out for a couple of weeks when someone broke into her apartment. Kyle suggested maybe she and her 16-year-old daughter should move in with him.
He was like, your daughter will be safe. You and your daughter, what if they come back in the middle of the night and they come and they hurt you guys? Like, how will I know?
Desiree says she stayed over at his place more and more. When he questioned the friends she was spending time with, it made sense. Maybe they were a bad influence.
He knew exactly what he was doing.
They were on a trip with another couple when she says he suddenly turned on her. Kyle and his buddy needed to go do some army training and brought their girlfriends along for a weekend out of town. But when they sat down to dinner after a day of army stuff for the guys and shopping for the girls, something was wrong.
And I looked in his eyes and he just looked like a complete different person.
Back in their hotel room after dinner, she says he accused her of cheating on him. He grabbed her phone, blocked her from leaving the room, and ripped the hotel phone out of the wall when she tried to call for help.
He ripped my underwears off and tied me up with my own underwear.
Desiree says later he apologized and he told her he loved her. But if she tried to leave to get help, he told her,
you think anyone's going to believe you? I'm a police officer. Like, no one's going to believe you over me.
You're going to hear a lot more about Kyle. We did talk to him for this story, and he says none of this happened the way Desiree says. But he didn't want to be recorded, so you won't hear his answer to these allegations. Later on, you will hear his voice, though, on a secret recording made at the time. Domestic violence cases often follow a predictable pattern. The aggressor sets it up so they can control their partner. Desiree now relied on Kyle for a place to live. She says he took her paychecks and tracked where she went using an app on her phone.
It was always like having to account from where I was and what money I had and, you know, and I didn't have anything.
He even alienated her from her daughter. The last place she had to turn when they got into an argument that she says got physical was the police.
911, state your emergency.
Officers showed up at the house. Desiree spoke to a female cop.
She came with an officer that knew Kyle, and they were really good friends, and he called him Chewy.
In a whisper, Desiree told the woman about what had happened 2 weeks earlier on the trip. She says she hoped Kyle couldn't hear her from where he stood, just about 15 feet away. The officer got a recorder from the car and asked Desiree to tell her again what happened.
She said it in front of him, and then he looked over at me, and I was all, nothing.
You don't do that. The victim's not going to tell you anything. You're going to place the victim in more danger.
Tom Walsh has been a cop for 41 years. We asked him for his take because he's been training other cops on how to conduct domestic violence investigations for decades.
You got to separate them so they can't hear one another and see one another. Because the victim knows, you know, when he gives me that look, the beating's going to be coming later. So, I mean, that's just standard, basic, simple police work.
but for some reason, the officers didn't follow what Walsh says is protocol. The reports from this incident state that because Desiree seemed drunk and changed her story, there was no probable cause to arrest Kyle. As they went to leave, Desiree says she heard the female cop say something to Kyle.
The girl said, "Kyle, what are you doing? You know you're already under investigation. Like, you need to, you know, watch yourself."
Kyle was already under investigation because months earlier, his ex told the department that he kicked her, tried to throw her down the stairs, and raped her. There's not a lot of research on how often police officers abuse their partners or their kids. Walsh says he didn't realize how big a problem this was until other officers started coming to him, asking him how to deal with these kinds of cases.
Unless you walked in the shoes of a cop, you're really not going to understand this. But it's shocking when you show up at someone's house that you get sent to, then all of a sudden you have a police officer on the other side of the door, and now they're a suspect who might be beating their girlfriend and their wife.
And he saw cases like Desiree's going sideways over and over again. Desiree says after police came and did nothing, she felt even less able to speak out to get help. She says Kyle told her if she talked, he would punish her.
Then after that, he had pulled up these like videos and pictures from the military. And there was these guys, and they were tied up the same way that he had tied me up. They were on their knees, and they were tied up, and they had like their eyes covered. And he was like, "I'm not scared to kill anybody, and like, and I will, you know, kill you and bury your body. Nobody will find you. I'll throw you in a ditch somewhere." And so at that point, I was just so scared, and I didn't know like how I was gonna get out alive or anything. And then so, you know, I just kept trying to like figure out like how am I gonna leave.
A few days later, Desiree thought Kyle was going to follow through with these threats. She says she escaped their house through the garage. A neighbor called 911, and this time Desiree thought police would have to act.
And then I just felt like, oh, such a relief. Like, oh my gosh, like, it's over. It's done.
Quietly, she described to a female officer how Kyle placed a pillow over her face and tried to choke her with her own arm.
I was telling her, and she's just like, "He's going to get arrested."
But then a senior officer, Sergeant Fred Sanders, overruled her.
He says, "No, we're not. They're good people. I know the Penningtons, and we're not going to arrest them."
These officers weren't from Clovis, Kyle Pennington's department, but from the neighboring town of Sanger, where his father was also a cop. Desiree says Sanders asked her to verify that the argument was just verbal.
Kyle was standing right next to him, and I looked at Kyle, and Kyle's like, "Go ahead." And then I was like, "It was just verbal." And he's like, "Okay." And then Kyle's like, "Go back inside the house now." And I had to walk all the way back to like where he like had tried to just try to kill me.
Kyle spoke to the police for a few more minutes and then came back inside. Desiree says he dragged her by her hair into the next room, where he beat, sexually degraded, and raped her.
He said to get dressed, and that was it. And I just, like, was like, this, like, I'm trapped. Like, there's nothing, like, he said no one's going to believe me and no one's going to help me. And, you know, and he's right.
Domestic violence investigator Tom Walsh says an abuser's fellow officers often can't see past the person they know from the station.
He's very professional. He makes really good arrests. He writes really good reports. But this poor guy has a miserable home life. And they don't understand domestic violence enough to know that they're being manipulated by the batterer.
Walsh realized the classes he was offering weren't enough. They needed specific training for dealing with officers who were suspects. So he created a program that he now teaches across the state. But those trainings aren't mandatory. In Desiree's case, a detective did follow up. Kyle was finally arrested and charged. When he bailed out, she promised him she hadn't told the police anything. Still, the police department suspended him, and then Kyle resigned. As the case progressed, Desiree found herself in the strange position of living with her abuser and going to battered women classes at night that the judge had ordered her to take.
I thought, well, why do I have to take these? You know, like, I'm not the one who's, like, in trouble. But I thank God that the judge ordered me to go, because I was going to these classes and I was learning things that I didn't even know that was abuse.
And Kyle stopped hitting her. Desiree says he didn't want her going to class with bruises. But then, the night she got her certificate, she says everything blew up again. And Kyle split her eye open with his fist.
And I knew then, I felt like I had enough knowledge to, okay, well, this is wrong. Like, this is wrong, and I need to leave, and I need to get out of here, and I'm gonna try one more time to reach for help.
Kyle was arrested again.
A former Clovis police officer is now facing additional charges after he was arrested for violating a restraining order. Only Action News was there today when Sanger police arrested Kyle Pennington this afternoon.
Their final breakup when it came was messy, with accusations on both sides. But the upshot was Desiree moved out. After about 8 months of abuse, she says she was broke and broken, but she was alive. Kyle went to trial in late 2013. He maintains that Desiree lied in court, that he never hurt her, and the only thing he's guilty of is trying to make the best of a bad relationship. But Desiree did share some pretty compelling proof in Kyle's own voice, telling her to stick with the story.
He was sticking with the story, did it. Freaking, he got bruises from moving, working out or something. And our whole thing was verbal last night.
This is from a secret recording she made, so someone would believe her that it wasn't just verbal, but physical.
No, they're just going to think that I'm just some drunk, and I'm not a drunk.
He tells her it doesn't matter what people think about her.
It's better than them coming after me, don't you think?
Police had access to these recordings Desiree made, in which Kyle admits to headbutting her, laying hands on her, and refusing to take her to the doctor. But the jury never heard those tapes. It's important to say here that despite allegations from Desiree and Kyle's other ex-girlfriend, he was never charged with rape. Kyle points out that his ex-wife of 15 years testified that he was never violent with her. Kyle was found guilty of violating a restraining order and pled no contest to misdemeanor domestic violence.
Deputies allowed Pennington to hug his family members who came to support him. Then they took him to jail to serve a 30-day sentence.
People tell me, too, they're like, well, it happened in 2013. Like, why are you still doing it? Like, why, you know, and it's, they want you to give up.
What she's not giving up on is a lawsuit she filed in 2015 against not just Pennington, but also the other officers who she says violated her constitutional rights by failing to do their jobs, failing to help her. A federal court ruled those other officers couldn't be held accountable, but she appealed. Right now, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals is considering whether those officers can be held accountable. If this court rules in her favor, it would create a legal precedent that could help protect other victims. That's why Desiree says she's still pushing it forward. Domestic violence investigator Tom Walsh says even that change won't be enough. He wants to get the issue of officer-involved domestic violence in front of lawmakers.
Listen, you need to do something about this. This is out of control.
He says the law needs to change to make it a crime to interfere with an officer-involved domestic violence investigation, not just for the responding cops, but for the whole chain of command.
I'm talking about chiefs and sheriffs, deputy chiefs and commanders, or whatever rank you want to throw in there. Until they hold those people accountable, nothing's going to change.
Desiree Martinez says she's still scared to be seen around Clovis. But she's working with a group of domestic violence survivors to let them know help is out there.
I know how it felt when no one helped me and no one was there. So I just don't want anybody else to ever feel like they don't have anyone there to help them.
If the Ninth Circuit rules in Desiree's favor, the officers involved in this case could go to trial within about a year.
Again, that was KQED's Suki Lewis.
That case was from 6 years ago, but domestic violence remains commonplace in the San Joaquin Valley. So common that last month, law enforcement agencies warned cases appear to be increasing after a Fresno nurse was shot and killed by her ex-boyfriend. One organization on the front lines of domestic violence is the Marjorie Mason Center, a Fresno nonprofit offering services and safe houses for survivors. FM89's Carrie Klein spoke with the center's executive director, Nicole Linder.
On an average year, we serve a little over 6,000 total individuals. That would include adults and their children. Two-thirds of our residential beds are taken by children. And so on a given day, we have about 80 children in our shelters. Our goal is to help stop that cycle of violence. So the longer a child was exposed to violence in the home, the more likely and prone they are to repeat behaviors that they witness. So our work with the children, even within our residential shelters, is key to their long-term success as well. From January through April of this year, for some reason, we have seen a significant increase. So did Fresno Police Department. I'm pretty sure the Sheriff's Office, as well as Clovis PD and the other law enforcement jurisdictions as well. There was a day, at least a period of time in the month of May, where even though our capacity is to house about 350 adults and children, we were housing about 450. Thankfully, those numbers have gone back down to more manageable numbers, but nobody's quite sure. We in the Central Valley experience really high rates per capita of domestic violence, and we attribute that to stressor indicators such as substance abuse, poverty. The heat is always a determining factor. So our concern as an agency, as well as law enforcement, is we had already seen such spikes at a period of time where we had really, really cool weather, and we have lower unemployment than we have in the past. But we are entering into summer, and so we just want to take this moment to encourage people. It's never too early to ask questions.
And so you said that you're not, it's not quite clear why these numbers are increasing, especially since, as you said, a number of the stressors you might associate with higher numbers of domestic violence are not actually off the chart high right now. I mean, could it be simply that more people are reporting crimes, either for themselves or for loved ones, anything like that?
Yeah, I would guess that there is a higher degree of willingness for people to seek help. And I think if you look at some social movements such as the Me Too movement, there has been an empowerment for people to not stay in the shadows and to get help and to say that what they're experiencing is wrong. I think that we've sadly had some very serious local tragedies in our community. I know that after the ICU nurse at St. Agnes was murdered the beginning of May. We attribute our spikes in May to that because I think it really scared people because here was a very well-educated woman at the top of her pedigree as it related to her job. She owned her own home and she really had everything dialed in. She got a restraining order the day before. And so I think it really scared people that maybe the threats of I'm going to kill you, nobody will see you anymore, are things to be taken seriously and not to just wave them off as, oh, he or she says this all the time, and I don't really actually believe they're going to do it, because at some point they actually will.
And so when you say spikes after that, you don't mean that more violence occurred after that, but that more victims or survivors were willing to come forward.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, we just heard a radio piece about violence that occurred back in 2013 from a Clovis police officer. And then, of course, as you said, the Marjorie Mason itself was born out of violence, a murder from a sheriff's deputy. I mean, is there an association between domestic violence and law enforcement?
Well, I think we would be unrealistic to say that domestic violence is absent from any profession. The reality is there are people who are controlling and abusive that are in all walks of life and all fields. What I do appreciate is the partnerships that we have with law enforcement and the fact that they have started to develop internal controls to address these situations. When people call here and say that, you know, they're afraid to report because their partner is a member of law enforcement, we will work with them to help encourage them to do the reporting in a safe way. Perhaps it's reporting to a different law enforcement jurisdiction. Perhaps it is making sure that you have an advocate with you, but to reduce that fear of retaliation. But I wouldn't say that the percentages are higher. I obviously don't do that research, and that would be something that maybe would be good to come from like the district attorney's office as well, but I would be wrong to say that they are immune from it.
What are some other efforts and community groups, on the ground here in the Fresno area or anywhere here in the San Joaquin Valley that you think are doing some really exciting work when it comes to domestic violence, either prevention or services?
Yeah. Well, we feel really, really blessed that we have such great partners that we work with directly and indirectly. I think one of the first shout outs, only because I saw it yesterday, is Kaiser Permanente. If you are a member of Kaiser, you will notice they have signs in their bathroom stalls that talk about, are you in an abusive relationship? They have a very comprehensive checklist that their physicians go through with their patients. They're intentionally trying to screen for it. Blue Shield Foundation is currently working with a nonprofit organization locally called Cultivas La Salud to try to investigate and put together a comprehensive prevention plan. Centro La Familia works specifically with our non-citizen population, helping them obtain things like U visas and T visas and represent themselves in court. And so we have some great community partners. In addition to, we work directly with the Fresno Madera Continuum of Care. We directly work with places like all the other DV shelters in the community. So whether it's Martha Diaz Shelter in Madera, Family Services Tulare County, we have some great partnerships with them, which we often have to transfer clients back and forth from for their own safety. And then I would specifically say our law enforcement partners, our hospital partners, in our school districts. As we spoke recently over the phone, the school districts have been gracious to partner with us in providing prevention education to our youth. Our goal is to start early to let kids know about healthy relationships and to really recognize the signs of unhealthy ones. They don't recognize them. A recent study said that 75% of parents feel that they've talked to their kids about healthy relationships. But when they surveyed the kids, 75% said that their parents had never talked to them about healthy relationships. So my encouragement is to, one, do a self-reflection. Sometimes our own relationships are unhealthy, and we have to first be willing to address them. Second, stop pretending that there's topics that are off the table with your kids. The best thing that you can provide your kids is not another soccer training or another music lesson. The best thing that you can do is prepare them for the real world, because once they are out there and exposed, you've missed your opportunity to be that trusted resource. Talk to them about the fact that dating and domestic violence is really about power and control. It looks different in teenage relationships. It looks things like digital abuse and trying to track people and where they're going, getting mad and frustrated. But I will tell anybody, if you recognize signs and symptoms within friends and family, please encourage them to get help right away. If somebody you know is having a conversation about their partner and they're agitated, they start to look like irritated or afraid, or maybe their phone has been blowing up and they start to look stressed, like, I need to answer this or they're going to get mad. Maybe they cancel on you every time you're trying to go to dinner now, even when that was a key relationship, because they don't want their partner to feel like they're ignoring them. Those are red flags right away. So anybody that looks irritable at all about disappointing their partner, those are red flags. We talk to kids, we talk to adults, that healthy relationships are built on mutual trust and respect, and that has to be the core and foundation for a healthy relationship.
Okay, well, I've been speaking with Nicole Linder, Executive Director of the Marjorie Mason Center. Nicole, thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a great day.
If you or someone you know has been the victim of domestic violence, the Marjorie Mason Center runs a 24-hour confidential hotline. It's at 559-233-HELP or 559-233-4357.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Monica Velez. Last week, we brought you a story about high schoolers in Merced asking for a mental health class and getting one. This week, moderator Kathleen Schock digs deeper into youth and mental illness. She's in our studio with Christina Valdez-Roop, executive director of the Fresno National Alliance on Mental Illness, and Abraham Perez from Edison High School, who has spent the last 2 years teaching a mental health class as part of the school's biomed career pathway.
So, according to the National Alliance on Mental Illness, 1 in 5 children ages 13 to 18 either have or will have a serious mental illness. Christina, is that indicative of what you're seeing locally? Those are national statistics, obviously.
Yes, that would fall in line with what we see locally here. The family members that I interact with youth that are experiencing a mental health challenge, seem to fall in line with that. I might even say we see that a little bit more, but they're calling us for that specific reason. So we're able to guide them and support them the best way we can. The fact that they're reaching out is good, very good.
So when you say support, what kinds of support are you able to offer?
NAMI provides education, support, and advocacy work for people who are affected by mental health challenges. So we're providing a lot of education to our families to understand what's happening. What is mental illness? What do the symptoms look like? What is the language to use? And then offering support groups for them so that they have a safe space to go to open up and share what's going on in this journey, where they don't have to worry about feeling discriminated against, being judged, or being told they may be doing something wrong, but really just expressing that emotional cycle they're on. And then the advocacy component is speaking up and educating our community about mental health and the importance of it and what steps to take to maintain good mental health. What happens when it looks like it's changing, where they may go. Also advocating for increase in resources to be available, helping to increase the workforce so that we have access to providers, and working diligently to improve the laws around mental health challenges and getting those individuals who need help to get help sooner than later, where we intervene before it's true crisis and they're at their worst.
So we're going to talk about the workforce problem in a minute, because I know that's really important. But before we go there, can you talk a little bit about the treatment of mental illness for children and teenagers? How does that differ from the treatment of adults?
Well, you have an adult family member or a guardian that can help support what might be needed, that's kind of overseeing their care with them, you know, and guiding them, still supporting the youth. With adults, it's different, because once you turn the age of 18, you can make your own decisions. And unfortunately, on this journey comes a lot of difficult things, side effects with medication, different types of treatment, a lack of awareness of knowing that you're ill and getting help. And sometimes, even though we encourage people to take that step to get help, it's still very difficult to do that. Whereas with our youth, we still have family members who may be much healthier that can help take those next steps to help get them help. It's still difficult, though, even for our youth.
Oh, certainly. So another stat that I came across when I was doing some research for this conversation was from the National Institute of Mental Health, that reports that the average delay between the onset of symptoms and intervention is 8 to 10 years, which is just a staggering statistic. In your experience, what are the factors that contribute to that delay?
The biggest factor is stigma. It's very difficult for someone to speak up and say something's wrong with my mental health. Because people automatically make assumptions that are myths, and we're trying to work really hard to reduce that stigma. They may be scary. They may be discriminated against. One of the bigger issues is being labeled. Now I have a label I have to carry around with me because I have mental health challenges. The other issue for that extended period of time, I believe, would be the lack of knowledge. We don't know what words to put with this. Children don't describe mental health challenges the same way that adults describe them. As an adult, you may be able to express what depression is and use the language that a provider may be looking for. A child isn't going to do that. They're going to talk more about their physical symptoms and feelings, maybe. And so being able to recognize the language in those two different populations would be very, very helpful. But I would go back to stigma being the biggest reason. Parents don't want their children labeled either. They don't want them treated differently. When we can reduce the stigma and guide people knowing where resources are, and then having those resources available, we would be able to get help sooner than later. And that's why our efforts really do spend some time in prevention and early intervention and education.
So if you're just joining us, you're listening to Valley Edition. We've been in conversation with Christina Valdez-Roop, the executive director of the Fresno chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Also joining us is Abraham Perez, a teacher at Edison High School. Abraham, you have a really interesting course that you lead at Edison High School that tackles the issue of helping to support the workforce of healthcare practitioners. Tell us a little bit about this course.
Yeah, the course is called Mental Health and Illness. It's the second year that I'll be that I'm teaching this course at Edison. It's a brand new course. It's a CTE course. It's designated for students who are interested in learning more about mental health and illness.
And if I could just interrupt you, yeah. CTE is Career Technical Education, correct?
Yes, yeah. Yeah. And so it's this year-long course. We talk about stigma, stereotypes. We go into depth about different illnesses. And at the end of the course, that's when we explore different career options for the seniors.
So what kind of feedback are you getting from the students as they go through this experience?
Great feedback, actually. They say it's much needed. I find that a lot of students are very stressed. They suffer from anxiety. And so not only does this course allow them to explore different options, it also provides them a space for them to vent and share their experiences with other classmates.
You know, when I was in high school many, many years ago, mental illness, mental health was not something that was commonly discussed. But it seems like in popular culture that is shifting, that students today have the vocabulary to discuss mental health in ways that previous generations had not. Is that what you're finding?
Yes. And with technology, they are more aware. They're more they are more exposed to different things. And so the conversation is needed. They know what's going around. They know how they're feeling. They just don't know how to fully express that.
So, Christina, I would like for you to talk a little bit about why courses like this are so important.
They're extremely important for a few reasons. The biggest reason is we have such a shortage in the mental health field with adequate providers at different spaces. We're not talking just psychiatrists and just psychologists. We're talking about therapists. We're talking about school counselors, individuals who are RNs that are working in our emergency rooms. That's one of the first places that people may go to in a crisis, in one of their initial breaks for care. And the more health careers that are available that understand the need for mental health support, we have an opportunity to provide better resources for our community. So that's one aspect of it. Many of the community members, when they reach for support, we're very motivating when we encourage them to reach out and get help. That's one of our consistent messages. But it's so disheartening when you reach out, you're not feeling well as it is, and you're told that you're going to need to wait not just a week, not 2 weeks. Sometimes you're waiting 6 weeks or more for a provider to give you an assessment to help you understand what your next steps are. That's a long period of time for your mental health to continue to decompensate, which can alter your perception. It changes the way you feel and respond to things. And then our behavior follows in all of that. And so we tend to do things that we wouldn't normally do if we were living mentally healthy. We can't process some of life's challenges that come to us in a healthy way, in a reasonable amount of time. The importance of understanding the need for additional mental health providers, everyone experiences challenges in their mental health. And with the statistics being 1 in 5, that could happen to anybody, whether it's yourself or someone very, very close to you. My hope is that we're working to improve the need we have now. But for those children, our future grandchildren, our parents, and us as we age, that there be an adequate mental health system available to us to navigate help when we need it, just like there would be other medical providers for us.
So I'm wondering, you know, we're now in June, of course, school is out for the summer. Is this a particularly fraught time for teenagers when they're facing perhaps mental illness without the structure of the academic year?
Yes, it's a transition period for our youth, and youth respond well to structure and routine. There are also resources available to them, whether it be the school psychologist or a counselor on campus. You also have your trusted adults there, which may be other teachers and coaches. Trusted peers in your peer circle are available to you. When we transition into a different period, some of our youth are going home to healthy homes. Some are not. And some are transitioning to be care providers for other family members or financial providers for their families, or maybe in other stressful situations and they don't have that routine anymore and access to those resources. So where do they turn? We have to make sure they know those resources before they leave the campus for the summer. So, because there are resources available throughout the county that they can reach out to. Online resources are also very, very helpful for our youth. But making sure that there's an opportunity to share that with them is extremely important as they transition. And those coming back in after summer have to transition from no routine to routine. Or now I'm no longer able to care for my family in whatever means that may be because I have to go to school. Where do I find balance in that? Or I'm going back into an environment that might not have been so healthy for me at school. How do I face that? It's a multifaceted concern to look at, whether it's healthy or unhealthy, but it's transition we're looking at.
Abraham, I see you nodding your head. What are your experiences around this?
Yeah, I do definitely agree with Chris. Routines and structures are very needed for students, especially at this age. And one thing that I do notice is that when they return in August, sometimes their mind aren't really focused in academics. They're thinking about family and other responsibilities. So they come with a lot of stress, a lot of anxiety. And they're just trying to figure out how to communicate that with others.
And of course, how can you focus on learning when you're walking around with all of this anxiety and stress and all that comes with that? Mm-hmm. So to wrap up, Christina, talk to me about, from a parent's perspective, what signs parents should look for and what steps should they take to make sure that they are caring for their children in the best way possible?
Signs to look for, very notable ones, are changes in their behavior. If you have a child that is normally involved in things and engaging and interactive, that suddenly changes. And teenagers have a tendency to want to shift their focus. So if they're spending time with others, that's not an overwhelming concern so much as if they were involved in extracurricular activities and now they don't want to do anything and they're not replacing it with something else. If their sleep habits change and they want to sleep more than usual and they could sleep for an extended period of time, wake up for a short brief period and then want to sleep more, or they become isolated and withdrawn. Our youth are private at times, and that's okay. But secrecy, sneaky, that's different than wanting some privacy because they're experiencing adolescent changes. Those that may be having risky behavior, they normally wouldn't participate in anything risky. And by that, some of the examples that I use are somebody learning to drive and then driving recklessly. Someone jumping from buildings thinking that stunts are fun. Someone engaging in aggressive behavior, because that's going to be risky, that someone could be harmed. Those are things to look for in our youth. Anytime that we have a youth using substances of any kind, it is a need to be concerned. Why is that youth choosing to use any type of substance, whether it be a drug, alcohol, pills, marijuana, those things? We want to dig. We want to find out why. Being able to open that conversation safely at home is important. But remember, we are the parent, and sometimes we're not always the best messenger. So encouraging our youth to have a trusted adult that they could reach to is always important, as long as safety is always maintained for our youth. If safety is an issue, we've got to reach out and get help quickly to keep our youth safe. So building those relationships and having those conversations before we see crisis is very helpful, so that it's not an uncomfortable conversation when we do, if we see something change. And we want to be able to create safe space ahead of time.
Wonderful. Thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Laura Satsui. Before we go, it's time for the weekend, where we find out what people in the San Joaquin Valley do for fun when they have a little time off. Today, I'm speaking with Jeff Garcia, Ray Etchegoyen, and Gina Arsino in Lemoore. They're members of the King's Lions Club, and this weekend, they're bringing different breweries together for the annual King's Brewfest. Now, this is a 21 and over event, but from hoppy to light beers, IPAs to lagers, they say there's something for everyone, even non-beer drinkers. So this Saturday is the King's Lions Club Brewfest. Jeff, can you tell us a little bit about what does that event entail as one of you guys' big fundraisers?
Sure. The King's Brewfest has been going on for 6 years now, and we consider it the premier brewfest in the Central Valley. We have over 65 brewers coming. Many of them are local microbrews like Riley's, Hot Forge, Birch Street, and Tactical Ops. But we also have the big breweries that people are familiar with, like Firestone, Tioga Sequoia, Stone Brewery. But in addition to the beer, we have wine, we have non-alcoholic beverages, and we have a lot of food. We have a lot of local restaurants that come in and provide food samplings from Sushi Table, Chicken Shack, Dickie's Barbecue, Toshiko's, Fatty Albertson, and a lot more. So this is much more than just a beer festival. It's really a great food and drink and fun. And I want to mention that we have the Valley Cats coming back again this year. They're a really fun, energetic dance band, and they'll be back again this year. So it's a great, great evening, and we hope everyone comes on out to check it out.
And so, Ray, can you tell me, is there a big beer culture in Kings County?
There really is. It's more than a lot of people would think. I mean, we get a great turnout every year, and I think the fact that you see all the microbrews popping up, you know, we have a new one in Hanford, a new one in Lemoore. There's one going up in Corcoran. They're springing up everywhere. And if you go into any of the breweries that are open right now, it's always crowded.
And we shouldn't forget that this is a fundraiser. For the Lions Club, what does this money go towards?
So this is our biggest fundraiser of the year, and all the money that we raise for this event and all the events that we do throughout the year goes back to the community at 100%. For the King's Brewfest, our primary recipient this year is Valley Children's Hospital's pediatric cancer program. So that's something that's near and dear to our hearts, so we decided to support them this year. So they'll be out there as well accepting a donation from us.
And we will also continue to support King's Lions Complex with the Lemoore Rec Department. They'll also be a recipient.
And so, Jeff, if people want to come to this event, obviously it's not free. Can you tell us a little bit about like the logistical details?
Sure. So our Brewfest is a little bit unique from what other people may experience at other ones. So ours is $40 to get in, but that includes all of your tastings, all of the food, and all of the fun. So there is no additional charge for you to come and enjoy all the things that we have to offer. So that is a little bit different. I think that what makes us a little bit more economical and more fun. So hope you come on out for that too.
And Gina, what's the kind of people who come out? Jeff had mentioned this is like the premier sort of brewfest for the Central Valley. So do you get more than just Kings County coming out?
Yes, we do. We actually get Fresno County, Tulare County. Everybody comes out, they hear about it, they know it's fun. And we do get a lot of support also from the military. So our volunteers are wonderful to the community. So they're all helping out. And it's a little bit of everybody here.
Well, thanks to all three of you for taking the time to talk to me.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming out.
Those were members of the King's Lions Club talking about the King's Brewfest taking place in Lemoore tomorrow, which is Saturday, June 15th. The Valley Cats will be playing there, and the event runs from 5 to 9 p.m. You can find tickets and more information at kingsbrewfest2019.eventbrite.com.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on social media.
And don't forget to check out our app. It's called KVPR. It's available for free on iTunes and Android. The show is produced by me, my co-host Monica Velez, reporter Carrie Klein, and news director Alice Daniel.
Technical support from Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm Monica Velez.
And I'm Laura Satsui. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need. On the web at chcf.org.